It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What is it like to care about someone bad, someone evil?
You know, I almost remember that day like it was yesterday. It replays in my mind a lot. I was on shift that night. We got the call over the radio. It was time to wake him up. So I stood there and watched him get ready and fix his hair, put his suit on, put his watch on. He got dressed to the nines as best as he could. And we all knew that it was coming close. He sort of knew that too before he walked into the death house. And he turned around and said goodbye and said that we were all his friends.
That's the sound of the execution of Saddam Hussein. He was hanged in 2006 following his trial in Baghdad. And Adam Rogerson was an American soldier, one of the Super 12 assigned to guard Saddam Hussein during his trial. These were young men, many just out of basic training, who spent months alone in close quarters with a man the rest of the world reviled as the Butcher of Baghdad. They were there at the hanging and for the violent aftermath. As you can hear, Adam is still haunted by what happened. Will Barden-Wepper was also serving in Iraq at the time. He was an airborne ranger, and he remembers wondering what such young, inexperienced soldiers were doing guarding such a high-value prisoner and what effect that might have on them. Charles Monroe Kane talked with Adam and with Will, who's just come out with a book about the Super 12. It's called The Prisoner and the Palace.
You know, when they went over there, I think they were expecting to kind of do what soldiers expect to do, which is get into combat situations and potentially engage with and kill bad guys. I mean, that's why a lot of these guys joined to begin with.
Sure, a lot of these guys were hooked up during 9/11, right?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them joined out of a sense of patriotism. And yeah, so I think when they got this assignment, they had a mixed response. On the one hand, you know, I think they were intrigued by the idea that they would be with Saddam Hussein, but I think some of them were kind of bummed out that they weren't going to be outside the wire, sort of mixing it up with the insurgents, and that they'd be kind of stuck in one place.
I was a little surprised that these guys didn't have special training. I figured some bunch of high-level CIA guys would be guarding Saddam Hussein, but some kids, they're kids from like Kentucky and Ohio. That seems really strange to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, they were in some cases not far removed from basic training.
Some of them were 18.
Yeah, I mean, it was remarkable. They weren't special operators. They weren't, you know, CIA clandestine service personnel. I mean, they were just basic young soldiers. And then that combined with kind of the intimacy of their interactions, I think, was what really struck me about how unusual this was.
They were not allowed to tell anyone, right?
Correct. I mean, that's one of the things I think that made this mission particularly challenging was that, you know, here they were sitting a few feet away from the most wanted dictator, you know, on the planet.
Right.
And then they would get on the phone with their families, like we can fortunately do nowadays from these deployments on occasion. And they would, you know, have to invent essentially a cover story. And their family would ask them what they're doing. And they'd have to say, oh, you know, I'm pulling guard duty in a guard tower. It's pretty boring. There's nothing really exciting going on here. And you can imagine how much some of them would have liked to have shared, you know, with their families and with their loved ones, the truth of what they were doing.
We came out of the 101st. We actually didn't know that we were going to be Dawn, the Super 12. It's sort of something that we just fell into. It was kind of crazy when we found out that we were taking over this mission. They hand-selected us out of our company. We all had certain skills. I was 22.
What was it like the first time you met Saddam Hussein?
People have souvenirs with his, you know, they're bringing home money with his face on it, and you're like, wow, you know, that's kind of cool, but nothing could prepare you for meeting him for the first time. I mean, he was sleeping in his cell. It was pitch black, and you sort of had to just navigate your way through, and you could just hear him sleeping. Once he heard us come down, he got up to use the bathroom, and I'm just standing there like, I can't believe that Saddam Hussein is taking a leak right here. I mean, this is the first time I ever meet him, and you know what I'm saying?
It was just, totally, man. It's crazy. It's surreal as hell.
It was just weird.
Did you say hi to him?
Oh, no. I mean, it was kind of an intimidating moment. I didn't know what to say. You know, I just kept quiet and just, you know, the dude was sleeping. So I respected that a little bit. And I was just there to make sure no one tried to get at him.
I got to ask you, I mean, you're a 22-year-old American from Ohio, and you got Saddam Hussein, who's not a 22-year-old American from Ohio, and you're alone with him. What did you guys talk about?
Well, right off the bat, it was sort of, we were sort of just feeling each other out. And what I mean by that is, you know, he would be sitting there staring at us, and we would be sitting there staring right back at him, and we had to break through some sort of, it was a lot of staring. Because, I mean, what do you say to this guy? I mean, when it's, you know, nighttime and he's relaxing, smoking a cigar, and just wanting to BS, you know, we would listen to the radio. We would sit by his little electric heater. He talked about his kids, you know, and he always told us that he was getting out and he was going to escape or someone was going to come get him. And we would just laugh and, you know, smirk at him like, yeah, okay, you know. But, yeah, I mean, we would reminisce, and he spoke perfect English. I don't know. We would pass the time. He was passing his time, and we were passing ours.
Now, I don't want to be boring, but I think there's a kind of a question I want to ask here, because I was like, oh, they guarded Saddam Hussein. Yeah, there's a monitor. They're behind some cement thing. They're looking at him, and he's in solitary confinement. But that's not how they guarded him, right? How did they guard him? How did it work?
Well, you're right. They needed to be, the way they described it to me was essentially within lunging distance of him, pretty much at all times.
You said lunging distance?
Lunging, yeah.
Sounds like we have a toddler. You got to be within lunging distance, right?
And it was, you know, ostensibly the primary objective was to just keep him safe from others that would be either trying to harm him or trying to free him. But in reality, I think also the concern was that he would do something to himself. And this was not too long after the Abu Ghraib scandal. And I think the Americans were very paranoid that if you bring Saddam into trial one day and he has a black eye, even if he did that to himself, you know, in the shower or something,
sure,
immediately the word's going to get out in the Arab world that he's being abused. And so there was a priority placed on ensuring that didn't happen, which required them to be in very close proximity to him at all times.
And not just close proximity to him, lunging distance, but one at a time. So, like, you're this kid from Ohio, right? And you're suddenly, like, arm lengths away from this dictator for how many? 8-9 hours in a row by yourself. That must have been a powerful experience.
You know, the instructions were essentially to keep your distance, and you're not supposed to go out of your way to engage him in conversation. But at the same time, it's kind of inevitable that if you're just sitting in a small concrete cell for 8 hours and there's nothing else to do, that there will be some dialogue. And what they experienced was that he would gradually, you know, look up from whatever he was doing. He read a lot, he wrote a lot, and he would ask them questions and kind of draw things out of them. And then, you know, as time went by, there would be more conversation, and they got to know a little bit more about each other.
Wow. They created a relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's really no other way to describe it as that.
Can you give me one example? The one that I think the most affected my heart, if I can say that, was the relationship between Saddam Hussein and one of the guards you named Doc Ellis. Can you tell me about that relationship?
When Doc Ellis got word that his brother was dying back home in St. Louis and he would have to leave on emergency leave, he made an unannounced visit to Saddam's cell to let Saddam know that he wasn't going to be there for a week because he didn't want Saddam to be upset at his absence. Such was the nature of their relationship.
Wow.
Saddam got up after Doc Ellis had told him why he was going to be gone. embraced him and said, "Don't worry, you're losing one brother, but I will always be your brother."
It is clear to me, it is very clear to me that these men, and whatever care means, cared about Saddam Hussein in some way, okay? You didn't get to interview Saddam, of course. Do you think he cared about them?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Was that embrace to Doc Ellis authentic?
I think they did care for him. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that it's a lot more difficult to play a role in the execution of someone that you've come to see as a human being.
Right.
You see them sleep, you see them bathe, you see them eat, you interact with them. Not only do you interact with them, but you've experienced him to be a sort of a charming, vulnerable older man. And that's more difficult than, you know, shooting at an anonymous enemy target from 200 meters. You know, there was a quote in the book that if our helicopter went down in Baghdad, you know, I'm convinced he wouldn't have hurt me. Such was, you know, the nature of our relationship. And some of the soldiers genuinely believed that.
Do you think he cared about you?
That's a great question. If something would have happened, maybe there's some people in the squad that he might not have cared about as much for. But if something were to happen and we would get overrun, I always thought that he would show mercy on me. So I, not that I was anything special, and maybe he wouldn't have. But I always thought in my head, maybe, just maybe, he would. And it was really crazy one night. You know, he was smoking a Cohiba. That was his choice cigar that we would give to him. He would have a certain amount of Cohibas that we would give him a day. He was looking through photos, and I was sort of just checking out what he was doing. And there were pictures of Fidel Castro and him on a boat. And I was like, oh, you know, that's kind of cool. I'm like, you know, you guys hung out? He's like, yeah, you know, he's the one who got me to start smoking Cohibas. And I was like, wow, like, this is crazy. He never talked to us about the evil stuff that he did. It was all, he was almost, I got the vibe, and this is just me, that he was almost sorry.
Now, of course, as we're talking about all this, and as this relationship is changing with these men and with Saddam and this crazy situation they're in, there's a trial going on. Tell us about the trial.
You know, he knew his country well enough to know that no amount of sophisticated legal argument would save him. And so what he did was, I think he viewed the trial as an opportunity to kind of rehabilitate his image in the eyes of his followers. And I think as he was an extreme narcissist, and when he got pulled out of that rabbit hole looking, you know, like a bum, I think that did a tremendous amount of damage to his, what he saw as his prestige. And so from that moment on, he resolved to present himself to his people as this defiant leader, a strong leader. And so that's really what he used the trial to do, was to project that image.
You know, during the trials, he accused some of the guards of torture. While they were there. How did the guards who would be starting a relationship with this man, how did they react to this feeble old man they were taking care of, now this defiant, angry man accusing them of things that weren't true?
Yeah, I mean, there's an account from one of the guards that he was, on the same day he was in court waving about how he had been mistreated by the Americans, he got into the elevator to bring him back down into the subterranean cell where they were holding him. And he laughed and he said, "Hey, don't worry about that. That was basically just for the cameras. But, wow. You know, you treat me great."
The trial ended, we all know, with an execution, a hanging. Could you tell me about that day, what happened at the execution?
You know, I almost remember that day like it was yesterday. It replays in my mind a lot. I was on shift that night, and we all knew that it was coming close. you know, we broke his radio so he couldn't hear. And we got the call over the radio. It was time to wake him up. And we did, and he knew. So I stood there and watched him get ready and fix his hair, put his suit on, put his watch on. He got dressed to the nines as best as he could. Once that was done, I left him, and then we all had to mentally prepare for what was about to go down. And that was pretty intense, because we figure if someone is going to come get him or he's planning to escape, he's going to do it now. So that was a very intense time, just cleaning your weapons and making sure everything was on point with yourself. Yeah, once we got there and he said goodbye to us, and I mean, then
What did he say to you? You personally, how did he say goodbye to you?
It was very sad. Once the commotion was over and we knew we were in somewhat of a safe zone, no one was going to come get him, and he sort of knew that too before he walked into the death house, and he turned around and said goodbye and said that we were all his friends. Some of us were crying and he was sad, but just for that split second to see him in an emotional state, it was crazy. We've been in firefights, we've been through IEDs, but at that, nothing could prepare you for that type of situation.
What happened after the hanging, immediately after?
They worked so hard to comport themselves in a professional, dignified manner and to treat him the way they were supposed to, and then it kind of all went to hell. And I mean, the execution itself kind of just resembled a disorganized sort of mob scene. And then in the moments after the execution, when Saddam's body was getting mistreated, you know, they were forced to essentially stand there and watch that.
I think that I was, I really didn't know what to feel. I've never seen anything like that in my life. You know, it was just like, wow, that, I mean, it was like Wild Wild West to me. Like I've only seen this in movies, but to hear it all go down, and it was intense. I was more protective than I was sad, because when you're asked to protect someone like that and no one's supposed to hurt him, and you just have that drilled in your brain, and it's easy to influence a 22-year-old when you see him kicking and spitting on his body. I just had more respect in the presence of death, I guess.
Another one of the soldiers would speak very candidly about any number of insurgents that he had killed, and he didn't have any real regret or remorse about that. But this experience had a profound impact on him, and so you have to step back and say, okay, well, why was it that he was able to kill from a distance and almost joke about it offhandedly? But here we are with essentially the worst of our enemies, and playing a role in that particular death really hurt him and troubled him. Hutch later reflected, "I feel like I have to explain why it bothered me so much for an American to be upset. But for us to stand by and let them treat another human being that way, I thought that's what we were over here to stop, the treatment like that. I truly felt that I was just as guilty as anybody else. I've never really had a conscience about anything I've ever done over here. As far as humanity goes, I've seen some pretty bad things. But my job had never before said that I had to stand there and watch people spit on and kick a person's body. And you know what? I'm glad I feel that way. I really am. Because if I didn't feel that way, I would think something was wrong with me."
So would you say that, I mean, I don't want to use this word lightly, but are you traumatized by what happened in Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I live with those demons every day. But don't get it twisted. Like, he was tried for his crimes, and that is the judgment that they came down with. And I'm not saying that he didn't deserve it. I'm saying that as a 22-year-old soldier, maybe I wasn't ready for that. I think though I wasn't the one who dropped the floor out, sometimes I feel like I did.
Adam Rogerson was one of the soldiers in Iraq who guarded Saddam Hussein. Will Barden-Wepper's book about them is called The Prisoner and the Palace. And Charles Monroe Kane talked with both of them. Here's my question. How can someone be a monster? In Saddam Hussein's case, torturing and killing thousands of people, he gassed his own subjects, and up close, seem like a decent, caring person. In other words, what happens when the moral categories, good and bad, that we sort people into, fall apart? I'm Anne Strangehamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
My name is Paul Beatty. I'm the author of The Sellout. The book I want to talk about, I don't know if I could recommend it in good faith, but it's a book I can't stop thinking about. It's called The Nazi and the Barber by a guy named Edgar Hilsenrat. And it's a book that was banned in Germany. I think the book came out in the early 70s, and it was banned for like 20 years because it looks at the Holocaust from the point of view of a guy who was a prison guard at a concentration camp. I don't even know if I like the book, but I can't stop thinking about the book because of the crazy questions that it's asked, the way that it treats the evilness that people bring to bear in all kinds of ways, and the way we forgive them and don't forgive them. It's a book that really just sits on your chest, and it just won't get off my chest. So, I mean, it's an easy book to read and to say, oh, you know, there's no culpability for a crime like that. I think it's easy to read that. You know, I could see being German and reading that book and going, ah, see, we're not responsible. And it's, the book's not saying that at all. And the book's also not saying that the victims are responsible, but it's asking that question about culpability, about responsibility, about forgiveness. I don't want to talk about the book without, you know, giving it away, but like, where identity is useful, where it's not useful, how it meshes, how we see people. You know, it's just a bizarre, bizarre book. I'm not religious at all, but the Holocaust, I mean, religion is obviously a part of that in some level. And it just talks about where true power lies.
That's Paul Beatty. He won the Booker Prize for his novel, The Sellout, and he just bookmarked The Nazi and the Barber, a novel by Holocaust survivor Edgar Hilsenrath. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. Thinking about some of those questions made me remember an interview Steve did a couple of years ago with a Norwegian journalist named Asna Sejersted. In 2011, white supremacist and neo-Nazi Anders Breivik killed 77 people. Most of them were teenagers he gunned down on an island summer camp in Norway. Well, today he's in prison and completely unrepentant. And Asna spent years interviewing, researching, and getting to know him. She says that while it's tempting to think of Breivik as a monster, he's also one of us, which is the title of her book.
He was born like one of us, typical in many senses. And then at some point, he decides to go against all of us. It would be too easy to say, you know, he is ill, he's sick, he's mean, he's evil, he's not one of us. When you go through his life, you see that he's actually quite normal. It's normalcy that strikes you.
So even though he committed this horrible atrocity, I mean, you know, killing 77 people, you do not use the word evil to describe him.
Oh, his actions are definitely evil. And I think, yes, he's evil. I think you could say that about him. But none of us are born evil. that does not exist. When does he become a terrorist? When does he become evil? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, we should just briefly sketch the outlines of his early life. I mean, as you say, he had a pretty miserable childhood. I mean, his father basically abandoned him when he was very little. He grew up with an unstable mother, I mean, probably mentally ill, never really fit in, and was wanted to fit in, but just couldn't for whatever reason, and just seemed to become an extreme loner.
Yeah, and there's so many, unlucky combinations in his life. Because, yes, he had a bad childhood, but it's like, I'm sure you have millions of children in the world who have much worse childhood than him.
Right, who don't become murderers then, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes a man commit evil actions like that? Probably something genetic. He has a history of mental illnesses in the family. Then it's definitely the lack of a father. And that's also interesting when you see many of the terrorists, the Islamic terrorists, the foreign fighters going to Syria. That's one unifying factor, a lack of a father. So then it's an instability at home, instable mothers, if we can, you know, talk in headlines here a bit. So she has this love-hate relationship to her son. I love you, I hate you, I wish you were never born, I want to give you away, I want to give you to, you know, foster care. And then in the next moment, she would hug him, they would sleep tied together at night. So definitely that is a bad start. And then there's something about him that makes him not be welcome. In his childhood, he reshapes himself and he remakes himself so many times to try to fit in there, in that gang with
right, these he tries to join various groups, and they always end up rejecting him. And eventually, as a young man, then he basically just goes off and spends years playing video games like World of Warcraft and Call of Duty.
Yeah, he tries to find a place to belong. He's rejected because there's something about him that people just don't, you know, they don't want him around. There's something. And then he loses his money because he desperately wants to become rich, because he wants to be admired. He wants to be seen. He wants to be something big. He wants his father, who saw him occasionally every summer holiday. But after he was 15, he never saw him again. He didn't want to see his son. So Anders Breivik was going around telling his friends, if I did something really great, something really big, maybe my father would see me.
One thing that's striking is in some ways how similar Anders Breivik is to the people he detests. I mean, the kinds of people who would go join Al-Qaeda, for instance, who've also committed brutal murders. I mean, it's the outsider who feels rejected by society, who feels isolated, and then looks for a grand cause and has violent fantasies that will bring him glory.
Yeah, and it's true that all extremists resemble. They have the same worldview of dividing us and them, good and bad, this wanting to cleanse, this wanting to purify the world or the caliphate, or in Anders Breivik's case, in his manifesto that he wrote, to purify Europe from all Muslims and all Muslim influence.
You said that the interesting question is when he became evil. I mean, he wasn't born that way. He committed these horrible acts. I mean, arguably the biggest trauma in Norway since the Second World War, since the Nazi occupation.
Yeah. It's probably, even though I posed the question myself, it's the wrong question, because he doesn't see himself as evil. He sees himself as doing good. Just as the Islamists in ISIS and in Syria would say, he sees himself as a savior. But when does that start? I think it comes quite late. So slowly he's going onto the even darker sides of the internet, which is the fascist sides, the white supremacist sides, and the neo-Nazi sides, and anti-immigration, anti-Islamist sides, and so on. And he, of course, again, he wants to suck up to the leaders, as he'd done all his life, trying to be a member of a gang. He wants to be a member of this gang. And then in the last moment, he's even rejected here. One of those who he'd contacted said that he hadn't bothered to answer him because, not because he was extreme, but because he was so boring. And so he's rejected even here. That was January of 2010. The next month, in February, that's when he starts to buy the weapons.
Let's talk for just a little bit about July 22nd, 2011, when he killed all these people, 77 people. I mean, first he blew up the government building, hoping to kill the prime minister, killed, what, 8 people there, and then went off to this island where lots of young students were. I mean, he would just walk from one kid to the next, shooting them in the head.
Yeah, he spared no one. And that's when I think this video game mentality comes in. He just shot and left, shot and left, shot and left. Beforehand, he had been calculating how many people he needed to kill to be famous. And to be famous, he wanted to be read because he wrote that big manifesto and he called the massacre his book launch because he wanted his manifesto to be read. And he decided that he needed to kill minimum 12 people and then he ended up killing 77.
What was the hardest part for you in telling the story?
To talk to the parents of these teenagers, because I felt when I contacted them, I felt that I was intruding into a family, intruding into a grief, and still I knew I had to do it.
Did these families want to talk to you?
Yeah, they did. So how did I choose? Because there's only 3 main families in the book. They kind of chose themselves. So what happened during the trial, there's a very strong guy whose name is Viljar, who's shot 5 times on the island, first in his thigh, in his shoulder, in his arm, and then last through his eye. The doctors don't understand how it's possible. The brain was lying outside of his skull. And then the policeman who came after the massacre, they think he's dead, so they don't take him. And then some policeman comes up to him and he finds this little pulse of this boy. And the policeman was a former soldier from Afghanistan, so he knew these war injuries. So he put the brain back into the skull and patched it together as you would do with a ceramic bowl or something, got him into this boat, taking him over to the other side. There's a helicopter waiting to take him to the hospital. He's in coma for 10 days. And there's one night when he's getting so cold and the doctor's telling the parents, you know, this is the end. But you have one last chance to give him the will to live. He must want to live. Talk to him, cuddle him, do whatever. And then a friend of his is coming and he's talking about, you know, what they will do when they will get out. And at some point, this friend is starting to sing and he's singing a song that they, you know, sang together. And early morning that, you know, after a long night, the boy in the bed, Viljar, starts to sing along with his friend. That's the start. And this boy now, he is studying psychology at the university now he's on his 3rd year. He's blind on one eye. He doesn't have a shoulder. He can't ski any longer. He can't do all those things that he loved to do before. But that boy was testifying in court. And I was thinking, you know, that boy has to be part of the book. And he went to Utøya with his best friends. There were 3. He was the only one to come back. So his 2 best friends are the 2 other main characters of the book.
Wow, what an amazing story of human resilience.
Yeah, I think it's important in the book that there are, you know, also stories of survival. Yeah, it's dark to get to know Breivik. It's not someone you really would want to get to know. I have to be honest to say, you know, I'm glad that I'm done with him. I'm never going to go back. I don't need to care about it. I'm done with him.
Asna Sejersted's book is One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. And Steve Paulson talked with her. So we've been talking this hour about whether it's possible to have empathy for people who have done terrible, evil things. Bloody dictators, mass murderers, serial killers. So let me ask you the same question about someone closer to home, your personal enemy. Because we all have people we don't like, maybe for good reason. But Chuck Klosterman says maybe you're missing something.
I had this incident happen around 8th grade. was a basketball camp in Fargo, North Dakota. And there was a kid at this camp named Rick Helland, who was, at least in our age group, by far the best player. He was physically imposing and more skilled and very talented. But, at least from my perception at that time, an awful person. Maybe the worst person I'd ever met. He was extremely egocentric, and he seemed obsessed with sex, which I know is a normal thing for an eighth grader, but I just found it very uncomfortable. And you know, he didn't listen to the coach, and he was always arguing with the referees, and he was just kind of a bullying figure that really stayed in my mind. I remember him going to high school. He went to different high schools, but he was a good athlete, so his name was in the paper, and then, you know, he ended up becoming a Major League Baseball player. So I follow this guy's career. I still feel the same way I did in junior high. So like I'm reading the newspaper, hoping to see that Rick Helland got shelled. He wins 20 games one year and I'm just so disappointed. And he pitches in the World Series and I'm mad the whole time. Well, I write a piece for Esquire basically about this where I make this passing reference to having this arch enemy. And then he retires, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess end of story. But then I find out, years later, reading an issue of Time magazine in the dentist's office, that Rick Helland, this guy who I'd spent my whole life sort of viewing as the antithesis of me, my arch enemy, was pretty much the first player in Major League Baseball to stand up and take a stand against anabolic steroids. Like, no one listened to him, but he was the first guy to be on record going like, look, this is a problem, it's screwing the game up, and there's going to be consequences if we don't step in. And then, of course, now, in the wake of what has happened, everyone looks back and go like, oh, Rick Helland was this truth pioneer. So I just had to come to the realization that the one person I am on record for hating is probably one of the most important baseball players of the last 40 years, despite the fact that his success on the field was very marginal. His import was that he refused to allow something that was wrong to continue happening without sort of standing up and saying, we need to change this. So, you know, that's kind of my life. Like, the people I hate end up being the heroes.
Chuck Klosterman. He's a cultural critic and author, most recently, of X, a highly specific, defiantly incomplete history of the 21st century. I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We debated when we were putting this show together about whether you would really want to hear this many stories about mass murderers and serial killers. But, you know, then I thought about what's on my Amazon and Netflix queues, and probably on yours. Breaking Bad, Hannibal, Game of Thrones. We like shows with killers. I mean, likable killers. We like bad people in fiction, too. Think of Crime and Punishment, Frankenstein, Lolita. So there's a theory that reading fiction helps us learn to understand other people. And in the process, we become kinder, better, more empathetic. Joshua Landy is a professor of French and Comp Lit at Stanford, and he agrees, sort of.
I think it makes you a better person, but it doesn't make you a nicer person. I think it gives you a richer life, and I think it makes you better at all kinds of important mental skills. But I'm rather doubtful that in most cases it makes you more altruistic.
Haven't there been studies, though, connecting, you know, the development of empathy with fiction?
That is a really interesting question. What they've shown is that you get a little bit better at what they call theory of mind, which is reading the mental states of other individuals. But there's actually quite a big gap between that and being nicer to people. These same psychologists have figured out that bullies, for example, have a fairly high capacity for theory of mind. Bullies are very good at figuring out what makes somebody else tick, and that's how they manage to torment them as effectively as they do. So there are various unfortunate lines of behavior that depend on you having a pretty developed sense of what other people are thinking and feeling.
Well, that's very creepy. I guess I would have thought that the experience of reading and getting emotionally invested in a character, it's not just coldly understanding how their mind works. It's an act of active sympathy, active empathy. You get invested in the character. You care about them. Maybe you come to love them. That's rather different from just developing a theory of their mind, don't you think?
Well, that's totally true. But again, you just have to look at the data. There have been plenty of people who've had that experience with literature and gone on not necessarily to be very nice people. So Plutarch gives the example of a tyrant, Alexander Phoreas, who used to weep at tragedies and then go back to having his citizens torn apart by dogs. And, you know, the famous examples are people like Goebbels, who was a big fan of Shakespeare, and my favorite, which is Himmler, who loved Siddhartha, which is Hermann Hesse's Buddhist novel.
So, you can argue that those are outliers, right? I mean, there are always going to be a few completely pathological human beings.
You can argue that. Suzanne Keene has done a fair amount of research on this. She tells this lovely anecdote of assigning her students in a class books about people in India and Haiti. And she asked the students, you know, how did this change you? And it turns out they called their mothers more.
Well, that's nice.
It's very nice. But what you get here is basically the influence of in-group bias. So there is absolutely caring for characters and empathizing your way into them. And it may even evoke some kind of warm, fuzzy feeling. But it's very like that warm, fuzzy feeling is going to get directed onto your own in-group.
Well, you could argue that, well, that's baby steps, right? I mean, at least they're becoming somewhat more empathetic towards their in-group.
Right. So that in itself is innocuous. I mean, so that claim would just be, look, let's ratchet down the rhetoric. Literature isn't going to transform everybody from a sinner to a saint. But I think there's a stronger way of putting it, which is very often we like to think that the point of reading works of fiction is for people to change their minds about something. And that, I think, is actually dangerous. People always cite the example of nice books that make people believe nice things. But I think if you encourage people to look to works of fiction to give them guidance as to how to behave, then all kinds of bad results are going to happen. So, for example, I know someone who went to see Edward Albee's play, The Goat, and concluded from it that bestiality isn't so bad after all.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's an odd conclusion, but I think it's kind of logical given the way that people are relentlessly told to understand fiction. They're told to extract a message, and if you don't, you're not doing it right.
I mean, I don't see what's wrong with a writer exploring moral or ethical questions, though. I mean, what about, you know, Crime and Punishment, a book that asks very pointed moral questions about crime and guilt?
If you put it that way, then that's exactly the kind of thing literature should be doing and that we as readers should be doing, is exploring questions. But that's very different from, as a writer, trying to change people's minds, or as a reader, just surrendering all critical thinking and giving yourself over to some point of view of an author.
So what do you think of something like, I don't know, George Orwell's 1984?
Well, I don't know what I think about 1984. I mean, there certainly are didactic works out there. And there's room for there to be those works as long as we don't encourage people just to surrender to them and accept whatever they think they're trying to tell them uncritically. I mean, Crime and Punishment's a good example because some people like to say, you know, we learn from Crime and Punishment that crime doesn't pay and you're always going to feel guilty. Would we really learn that? I mean, you could watch Crimes and Misdemeanors, Woody Allen's film, and conclude the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if you were to base all of your beliefs about the world on works of fiction, you'd become deeply confused.
Mm. So I take it you wouldn't go the other direction and say that literature exists for nothing but pleasure. It's just a form of entertainment and we should just lose ourselves in wonderful pieces of literature and characters and assume that it has no impact on us at all. So what do we get out of reading great literature?
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, in fact, one of my pet peeves is the kind of widespread idea that either literature is morally improving or it's just entertainment. which I think is very unfair, very unfortunate. I think there are a bunch of things that we get out of literary works. Some of them help us to feel things, and some of them console us, and some of them give a workout to really important mental skills, and some of them help us to understand who we are.
So a book can kind of break open feelings in us that we may have not been able to access. I guess I would have said there's something moral about that.
Well, I mean, you know, what I want to say is basically what they say on those, you know, those drug disclaimers. Results may vary. Right? So you may, you know, you may unlock your emotions and that may make you a nicer person, and I may unlock my emotions and maybe that will make me a slightly less altruistic person. It's really unpredictable. But what you can say is it's going to give you a richer life.
So what do you say to students who, I mean, you teach French literature, some of which is not necessarily the easiest or most fun stuff to read. I mean, you know, plowing through Beckett or even Proust. All those volumes of Proust.
Yes.
So why bother?
I think for the reasons I was saying, that there's really no substitute for an engagement with a truly extraordinary work of literature to get to grips with who it is that you are and what it is you really care about. And there's no substitute for exercising certain mental skills, certain tricks of mind that you can only really fine-tune by means of literary works.
Yeah, Joshua, I just read a survey in Great Britain. 63% of the men surveyed said they don't read books, or at least not many. What do you think the consequences might be for a society that stops reading fiction?
Well, all predictions are wrong, so I hesitate to predict, but I do think we're going to lose out on a certain set of opportunities, opportunities for self-understanding, opportunities for the cultivation of certain ways of thinking, habits of mind, possibly even opportunities for encountering our own feelings and, taking the axe to the frozen sea within us. Some of those things can certainly be satisfied by film and television, but I think there are going to be some things that are lost. Hmm. And I think maybe something like a certain kind of patience, a certain willingness to set foot in an experience that's going to take you days, maybe weeks.
Joshua, thanks for talking. This was great.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Joshua Landy co-directs the Literature and Philosophy Initiative at Stanford. He's also the author of How to Do Things with Fictions. Before we go, we wanted to hear from one more writer, talking not about fiction but nonfiction, a true story that I kind of had a hard time wrapping my head around.
Hi, my name is Michael Tisserand. I'm the author of Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. And the book I love and return to and recommend is a comic, a graphic novel, a memoir by Durf Backdurf. It's titled My Friend Dahmer, and it's his experiences going to high school with the serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. I love books that you think you're going to be opening a door to one kind of book, and you suddenly find yourself in the middle of something you totally did not expect to be standing in. You think you're going to open up to find lurid tales of Dahmer the serial killer. And instead, I found a high school that reminded me very clearly of my Midwestern Minnesota high school, his Ohio high school, around the same time period. And I identified both with Durf Backdurf and then also, in a very unsettling way, with Jeffrey Dahmer. He created a character for himself that he portrayed in high school, as we all portray characters to get by in high school. He ended up doing these impressions of his mother who had seizures, and he did it for attention or to get a laugh. And Durf Backdurf draws himself very clearly and describes himself very honestly, having Dahmer as a friend, not a close friend, but probably one of the closest friends that Dahmer had in high school. they would have sort of the Dahmer fan club, and they would get Dahmer to jump into the photographs that different high school clubs were getting taken for the yearbook. And Dahmer would, you know, show up in this club or that club. And then in the National Honor Society, they got Dahmer to be in that photo. A teacher saw it and blacked out Dahmer's face. And Dürf puts that photograph in the book as well, and it's eerie. And you see at one point Dahmer, who had a horrible family life, in tears. And, you know, you read the works of someone like Sister Helen Prejean, who's trying to bring you close to people who committed horrifying crimes and to see them as human beings. And I think Dürf accomplishes that through his art like no one else I've ever encountered. It doesn't erase your knowledge that Dahmer became a monstrous human being and committed unspeakable crimes, but it shows you a time in someone's life when someone might have made a difference.
Writer Michael Tisserand recommending the graphic novel My Friend Dahmer by Dürf Backdürf. There's a movie version coming out soon. You can check out the trailer and also a longer interview with Backdürf at our website at ttbook.org. And while you're there, sign up for the podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour with help from Doug Gordon, Mark Rickers, and Karen McKechnie. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.